And now, the conclusion of our conversation with the Right Reverend Gregory O. Brewer, Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Central Florida. Earlier on, you mentioned that 72 is the mandatory retirement age, and I believe you have 2 years before you have to retire.
That's exactly right. I knew you wanted to open that window.
And what I'd like to ask is, what do you plan on focusing on in the remaining 2 years of your term?
Well, actually, I'm working on that right now. Because to know that you have 2 years, because in July of 23, I will hit 72, which means I will step away. And probably that month or somewhere thereabouts, there will be an ordination consecration for the next bishop. And all of the diocese will gather for that. I will be there too. And after that bishop is ordained, I hand that bishop the diocesan crozier and I'm done. And so I've already, but 2 years is not a lot of time. And so it sharpens your thinking to know that you only have this much, so what must you do? And so I've really come up with, but it's an expanding list, you need to know. So this is in no way a kind of my job description only, because I still continue to function in the ongoing life and maintenance of the diocese, including pastoral care for clergy and working with the staff in a whole myriad of ways. So it's not as if I can clear my schedule only to do these things. But two things have come to mind already. One is I want to strengthen what we're doing in terms of reaching out to emerging new immigrant populations in Central Florida, including developing a first-class program for training people who are Spanish-speaking people for ordination. And I am looking far and wide, both inside the Episcopal Church and outside the Episcopal Church, for practitioners who do that well, who can help us design that and think it through, and really ask the question, what's the best way to serve these populations here in Central Florida in a way that may or may not look like some of the more established models? In other words, everything's on the table as we think about that. And so that's one thing that I'm doing in earnest. Second thing that I'm doing is that I want to find a way to strengthen the financial base of the Canterbury Retreat and Conference Center. It's in need of financial support. And our new director, a man by the name of Chalmers Morse, who has extraordinary experience in hotel renovation. He helped renovate the Plaza Hotel in New York City before he retired to Vero Beach. So he's got a deep, deep resume in this area. And he's also a very gifted believing Christian. And so he understands that the goal of Canterbury is to provide genuine, wonderful accommodations within a Christian atmosphere for people who want to come and use that facility. And so he's had to spend quite a lot of capital to, in essence, get Canterbury up to snuff because it had a lot of deferred maintenance. And there's never been an effort to build an ongoing donor base to help support what it is that they do, so that particularly churches and ministries that can't afford to go down and rent a hotel room at Disney, or even just a regular hotel room in Orlando, they can't afford to do that. So what could we provide for them? Because those are some of the people that we want to serve. And so I'm working now with the board. I'm a member of the board of the Canterbury Retreat and Conference Center on how we can develop a long-term donor plan to put Canterbury Retreat and Conference Center in better shape. So those are two things I'm actively involved in and will. And the third thing is I continue to be very involved in the wider life of the Episcopal Church. So those are the things that right now, besides pastoral care, clergy, and oversight of the diocese, where I'm trying to think about how I might serve over these next 2 years.
Let's talk a little bit about the pandemic. We've all come through what was a very rough time for many of the churches. They were not able to meet. And I'm just curious as to what the impact it has been that you are aware of on our churches in the diocese.
I think, first of all, it has been a very difficult time for almost everyone. I have met few, and I mean very few, people who have not personally lost someone close to them to the virus, who, as a result of the isolation, were not able to see family and friends, especially if they live in other parts of the country or in other parts of the world, and that it has been very emotionally difficult to, in essence, feel that kind of isolation, as well as from your own church family and the people that you love and care about. And so I do think even now, we are in the midst of a serious rebuilding, not just trying to rebuild what we did as a church, but for genuine kind of emotional recovery, for people to be able to think about the landscape has changed. It's not the same as it was. And the losses, particularly in some places, are significant. And so how do we live now, not only in the face of what we've lost, but also in the face of some ongoing uncertainties? A part of the challenge, particularly as a diocese, is that different communities have experienced the pandemic in different ways. Some far more hard hit than others. And that was particularly true for some of our more financially impoverished places. They didn't have the financial ability to not work. They did not have the capability to socially distance because they were living with extended family members who still had to go work their jobs. And as a result, they were far more hard hit in terms of death and even the vaccine distribution. I had to sort of breathe a sigh of sadness when I found out that one of the local grocery store chains had been designated as a COVID vaccine site because that particular chain is only in more or less middle-class neighborhoods. You'd never find that grocery store in some of the poorer parts of our cities, which automatically meant that there was less access, you see. And so some of our churches had to set up, particularly our Spanish-speaking congregations, had to work with local officials to become vaccine centers. So people would come to the parking lot because there wasn't a local grocery store around the country anywhere near them, I mean, in their neighborhood, not the country, to which they could go for a vaccination. And so we're in the midst of rebuilding. For some congregations, that meant they lost, through a major donor passing away, a significant portion of their financial income stream, and that's caused them to rethink what they do. Some of their key people have died or have moved away. Some people moved closer to children if they were older because they wanted to make sure that they could get the kind of care that they needed that they wouldn't have been able to get if they lived alone. They needed more attention than that. So a lot has shifted. And so we now are in the midst of a kind of a rebuild and trying to think about, we are a different church now. A lot of it's the same. Thank God we still see some of the faces we know and love. We believe the same things, but our communities are different. And how do we reshape what we do to try to minister not only to the people who are there, but to the people that we want to reach out to invite and be a part of the life of our church. So some really creative thinking needs to happen. And I think some of our churches are doing that. I mean, nobody would have thought that we'd be live streaming our services as now a normal practice for the foreseeable future. And even in some cases, have viable congregations that are only live streamed from other parts of the country or even other parts of the world. And that even be an income stream into the life of that church. I know several churches for whom that's true. or even some who have been confirmed. I mean, I confirmed a family that flew in from Ohio because they started watching online a congregation here in Central Florida, had no church background or experience whatsoever, and in essence were discipled into the faith and flew down for me to confirm them on one of my visits. I mean, it's remarkable what it is that's happening. And so we're different. And I think it's going to take a while to figure out what that looks like, but we're in the midst of it right now. So yeah, the worst, hopefully, God willing, is over. Even the variants are proving to be, at least in the United States, I mean, the vaccines we're giving are proving to be helpful in terms of those variants. And most of our congregations have been pretty compliant, not everybody, but most, in terms of wearing masks and complying with the guidelines. I mean, there were a few that basically said, you know, this is infringing on our constitutional right to worship the way we want, or to speak out of conspiracy theories, or, but very few, honestly, very few. And I'm thankful for that. So I think at this point, this has redefined something of our future, and we're still trying to figure out what that looks like.
Well, now I want you to pull out your crystal ball and tell us, what do you see as the future of the Episcopal Church in Central Florida? I think you've touched a little on some of this, but.
I think there is, in fact, an extraordinary opportunity for the Episcopal Church if we are true to our roots. And here's what I mean by that. We live in a society and a culture that is becoming increasingly tribal and polarized. That is certainly true for our politics, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. And that is even true for what's happened to us socioeconomically. There's more of a divide at the end of the pandemic between the well-off and the less well-off than there, it's more now. I mean, the stock market has roared for people who have investments, they're actually doing pretty well. But for people who don't have that socioeconomic cushion and in the uncertainty of the job market, they're much more financially nervous than they were before the pandemic started. So there's more of a divide there. And so we have an opportunity because we say that what unites us as Christians is baptism, sacraments, creed. Not where you stand on this issue or that issue. And the liturgy itself is written in a way that tries to envelop the whole of who we are as the people of God, to be able to stand on level ground together. Plus, a liturgical service, although it's a challenge for people, if they don't have the vocabulary that we use so frequently as a part of their normal lexicon, I mean, our liturgy actually is crafted in a way that presumes people to have a certain proficiency as it relates to the English language or any language. It's true for the prayer book in Spanish as well. It assumes a level of education that may or may not be true for everyone. But if people can get into the rhythm, what they discover is, and especially in times of crisis, is that the liturgy carries them. Particularly when you're under emotional duress, you don't have the wherewithal to try to make it up when you're trying to pray and pray effectively. And a part of what the liturgy says is, we're in this together and we're giving everyone a common language to offer even the deepest things in their hearts to God. So to be a church that says that's who we are and that everything else is on the table. So it doesn't matter what your cultural background is. It doesn't matter your education level. It doesn't matter your socioeconomic level or your race. You can come and find a place in this church, I think is extraordinary. If we're willing to take advantage to be that kind of church, rather than being a monochrome church that uses common language, but rather the language actually defines who we are in terms of the way that we live our life out together.
Are there any other challenges that you foresee for the Episcopal Church in the U.S. or in the Anglican Communion?
I do. And I think, first of all, the Episcopal Church is in the midst of some very seismic shifts. There are places where the Episcopal Church is thriving, and Central Florida is one of those places. But there are also places where the Episcopal Church is doing dreadfully. Populations have moved away, buildings have had to be closed, church attendance has dropped dramatically. There are plenty of people who prefer a more informal, contemporary praise music approach, you know, the preacher in just a regular open collared shirt, and like that. And many of those kinds of churches are thriving in places where the Episcopal Church used to thrive, but not now. That's a cultural shift. And so I think the Episcopal Church is going to have to think about who are we? And what does that look like for us? In other words, it's much bigger than a question of do you agree or disagree around gay marriage and still find a way to live together. We're going to have to think in new ways about what it means to be church. Also, all of the controversies that we are facing are also being faced by Canada and a lot of other Western countries that have put particularly our more progressive tendencies at odds with the vast majority of Anglicans, almost all of whom are far more socially and biblically conservative and are coming from sub-Sahara parts of the world. Africa, South America, Singapore and the Far East are all theologically more numerous and less conservative than we are. I mean, just one quote, there are more Anglicans in the country of Nigeria than there are in all of the United States and Canada combined. And that is actually mixed into a history from England that was both to its credit evangelistic and to its discredit very colonial, wanting to make everybody sort of brown or black English people. And there's some genuine and earned resistance in some parts of the United States to those kinds of colonial vestiges that are still present. And there are plenty of Anglicans that want to say, we're the numerical majority. Shouldn't we be having a bigger say in the direction of the global communion? And the communion has to decide what it's going to do with that. Not the least of which is the gathering together of all of the archbishops in the country, the primates, as well as the tone that the Archbishop of Canterbury himself sets. And we're trying to figure that out. What does that actually look like? And we are not of one mind. I mean, another way of saying we're trying to figure it out is to say we are not of one mind. and so I think we could be going through a pretty rapid set of changes, especially over the next 10 years, that will affect and impact who we are here in Central Florida, but also across the planet. And I think it's anybody's guess where we're going to end up, which I think is why it's so important for people to speak up and be a part of what's going on, because the future history is being shaped and it will be shaped by the people who step up and speak up, and that God will use them because this is his church. So that's what one of the reasons that I'm as active as I am, because I know we're in one of those points of history where things are being shaped for a different future than what we know now.
Now I'd like to ask you a personal question. You are married to your lovely wife, Laura Lee, for nearly 40 years and have five sons. And I believe you now have seven grandchildren. Six. Didn't you just have another one?
Yes, we have six.
Okay. Now,
Five
girls and one boy. Now, what do you and Laura Lee plan on doing once you retire? And I know some of your interests, you mentioned the dinner parties. And for those who don't know, you are a gourmet chef.
It's fun to cook. Hospitality is in Laura Lee and my blood. We love doing it.
But I'm wondering if you have in mind some other things that you've had to put aside while you were bishop.
Yes, but I'm still trying to think about what that means. A part of that is, I love theological education and the training of people for the ordained ministry. That's what I did at Trinity School for Ministry. And one of the reasons that we're making such large efforts to raise up new people in ordination, not only because of the need, is that I love that. I mean, that feels like home base for me. And I know that I will be involved in some way, and I'm not sure how, in some way involved in that. I also know that because of Laura Lee's family roots here in Central Florida, at least for a few years, we will remain here, even though only one of our five children live here. Three are in the New York City area and one is in San Francisco. And that's because it seems to me that our kids move. So if we want to move someplace different to be in your grandchildren, there's no guarantee that's going to remain the same. And so more than likely, we're going to stay where we are. And although it may not be in the same house or even in the same part of Central Florida, we certainly will probably be in Central Florida for the foreseeable future. So anything I do will be local, or I'll be via Zoom or on a plane to go do something in some other part of the world or another city and then come back. The glory of it is that in retirement, Laura Lee will be able to come with me. And I also know she has some things that she wants to be able to do as well, besides spending lots of time as a grandmother. We know other couples with grandchildren, and it's not unusual for the grandmother to get on a plane and go away for a week just to be with her kids. And I can certainly see Laura Lee doing that, particularly given the fact that they're so far away from where we live, but she should. And so we'll be certainly enjoying those things as well.
Well, I wish both of you a lot of fun and rest in two more years.
Thank you.
Do you have any parting remarks that you would like to make to our listeners?
Here's what I would say. Given everything that I've already described in terms of the changes that are going on both within our church as well as in our society, particularly here in the United States, but it's happening other places, all of that for me, for calls on Christians for more involvement and not less. This is not a time to withdraw. History needs you, both in your prayers. I hope we are taking seriously the call to pray for our communities, but also to show up in our communities, to try to make a difference, to be a voice for civil conversation, to care about the people who don't have voices, and to do what we can to really make our communities better places, because we understand those as our parishes, the places where we're called to serve. And if there's anything I want to see happen, even more than it is now, that occurs, that level of involvement, both in prayer as well as in showing up, because I think this is the time where compassionate Christians are deeply needed.
Well, on that note, we will conclude the podcast, and I thank you so much, Bishop Brewer, for spending this time with us today. Listeners, I hope you have enjoyed our talk today with the Right Reverend Gregory Brewer, and that this helps you to know more about the Episcopal Church. Remember to subscribe to our podcast, Musings on Faith, and be sure to tell your friends and family about them. You may send us your comments at musingsonfaith@gmail.com, or you may leave a voicemail message using the link at the end of the description of this podcast. Don't forget to follow St. George Episcopal Church on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you so much for listening.